Hello, I'm Dan Lebatard, and this week's guest is a bit of a pioneer, not just because he and Jimmy Kimmel were changing how some television was done a while ago, but he also sort of invented the model in America for being able to have a podcast and profit off it and have it be a substitute to radio. He invented an entire industry around what it is that he does. He's very funny, and his funny comes from a pretty dark place in a childhood that was very dry. So we'll get to Adam Carolla in a second. But before we do that, Mike, tell the people about one of the sponsors who helps keep all of this afloat so we could keep getting content to people. We ask only a couple of things of you for all of this free content. We ask that you rate, review, and subscribe. And we ask that you support our sponsors like ZipRecruiter. Tell them, Mike.
Dan, finding a new job is a lot of work. You're familiar with our friends at ZipRecruiter, and right now, I want you to check out ZipRecruiter's number one rated job search app, because they can have a personal recruiter help you find a better job using technology. That's what ZipRecruiter's technology can do for you. Just download ZipRecruiter's job search app and let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in. And its technology starts doing all the heavy lifting. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone who's just like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know, so if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter's app is rated number one. And right now, South Beach Session listeners should download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job.
So check it out for us. Support what we're doing here. Support ZipRecruiter. And now let's get to Adam Carolla. This guy right here has created an industry around himself doing creative things around the funny. He's got his first ever stand-up special, not Taco Bell material. It's available now for purchase, chassis.com, chassis.com, and it's also available on iTunes. It's C-H-A-S-S-Y. Why did you, Adam Carolla, decide to get out in front of people, strip down to nothing but your courage, and do a stand-up special?
You know, it's something that I always felt like was for other people and other comedians. I have a weird sort of self-esteem. And the fact that this stand-up special has the word special in it, and the Carollas don't do anything that's special. So I think it kind of kept me away from doing one. It was always like, that's for other people. But at a certain point, I realized I've been doing so much stand-up and traveling around and have so much material that what's wrong with doing a stand-up special? It was like I gave myself the permission to do a stand-up special. And I know that sounds stupid. From a guy who's had a bunch of TV shows and radio shows and written a bunch of books and made a bunch of movies and stuff like that. But I still felt like that was for other people. And I just kind of, like, almost emotionally gave myself the permission to go do a stand-up special, and it turned out great. So I'm very, very proud of it.
When you mention the self-esteem stuff, what are you talking about there?
I have a weird relationship with performing, which is like I have a lot to say and I'm good at saying it, but I come from a really downtrodden sort of weird family that never listened to anybody or me or never laughed or never encouraged or something. So I have a strong streak in me that always sort of says, you know, why are you talking in front of this group of people? Like, why would they pay you to listen to what you have to say? And I don't have stage fright. I have more like just kind of like, why stage fright? Like, what are you doing that's so special? And so I've always kind of had that, even though I love to talk, and I love to, you know, tell stories, and I love to tell jokes, but I've always kind of wrestled with my history, and my history is just really bad parents who kind of pounded the self-esteem out of anyone around them, to be fair. It wasn't just their kids.
I'm curious, though, because I've read some of the stuff that you've said about your father, and it's a bit heartbreaking because you were really good at sports, and he was not interested, it didn't seem like, what you were good at.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out, when I was a kid, my early life, I was good at sports, I was good at football, and no one in my family was interested in sports or football. So I sort of figured out, I was doing a kind of a kid math. And the kid math was, well, I guess your family doesn't like football. So, okay. And then later on in life, I got into carpentry and building and construction and that kind of architecture and building furniture and cabinets and houses and stuff. And nobody liked that stuff either. So, again, my math was just like, well, I guess they're not into football, and I guess they're not into building. And then I started getting into cars and vintage race cars and really historic and interesting race cars, and then racing race cars, and then racing cars and doing Long Beach Grand Prix, celebrity, blah, blah, blah. Version of that race, and I won in the celebrity race, and then the next year I came back and I won in the professional, the pro division. And my family's from LA, they all live in LA, but no one went, no one knew anything. And I thought, well, okay, they don't like cars.
Well, but you're not old enough. It's not kid math anymore. You're an adult. You're not even allowed in that car unless you're an adult.
I guess I was still like, I guess they don't like, you know, you like football and you like building and you like cars, and they don't like football and they don't like building and they don't like cars. So that's kind of what I thought. I mean, I knew they weren't that into me, but I also thought they just weren't that into cars or football. But then at a certain point, I'll tell you, when I really learned just kind of who they were was like just kind of recently. I mean, I always knew, but recently when I was writing for the Oscars and Jimmy was hosting the Oscars, and they do like the Oscars and they do kind of pay attention to the Oscars and they do like writing and books and stuff. And when they weren't into the Oscars and they weren't into Jimmy hosting the Oscars and they weren't into the documentaries I've been making and things like that, that's when I kind of knew, I don't think they're into anything.
Well, is it that they're not into anything, or are you finding all these things that they don't like and one of them is you? Because as you describe that, it hurts. It hurts to hear you say, like, you're talented at all these things and nobody's supporting it.
I don't think it's nobody, but it's nobody within the family unit, I would say, would be a accurate way of describing it.
And how did that transform into funny? Like, how did trying to please these people, like, where does is your funny from pain?
No, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe to some percentage or degree. I mean, the thing about funny is, you know, Jimmy Kimmel's a funny guy. I'm a funny guy. He comes from, you know, his parents are still together. He grew up in a pretty normal environment. He's, you know, fairly happy guy who grew up in a fairly happy world with really good parents. Like, his parents, Jim and Joan, are just top notch. Like, they're really good people. And blah, blah, blah. And he's in the comedy. I have shitty parents, and I grew up in kind of impoverished in a different world. I'm funny. It's just like, we're funny, you know, like it's sort of a, like playing the drums, you know, just like you want to pound on pots and pans when you're 6 years old, because you want to play the drums. And that's kind of the long and the short of it. I think we try to figure out who created funny and, or how funny was created. And I don't think that's right. I think that you're funny or you're not funny. And if it had to do with pain in a miserable childhood, then the entire continent of Africa would be hysterical. if you think about it.
Yes. And so the title of the stand-up special is not Taco Bell material, and it's because you were not Taco Bell material. Taco Bell rejected you. Where did the belief come from? Like, when did you start believing that you could do this? Because it didn't seem like you had a lot of belief behind you.
The belief part was kind of a luxury, you know, neither here nor there to me. It's still neither here nor there. I don't believe in anything other than it's time to go to work. You know, I just show up and I go to work. I don't have any pre-existing beliefs. My feeling is I was very poor. I had, my jobs were very uncomfortable jobs that involved a lot of, you know, digging and scraping and, you know, demoing stucco and busting stuff up and out and stuff. And it was just like a really kind of bleak existence. I didn't have air conditioning in my apartment. I drove old beater pickup trucks with, you know, crank up windows and no air. And I was just like I was unhappy. I was just like, I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm not doing it with people I want to do it with. And I'm broke. So I got to try to figure out something that's better than this. And I never believed in anything per se. I was just like, I'm going to start trying to move toward doing something that doesn't involve my back and coming home covered with dust, you know, drywall dust and cement dust. And, you know, just I don't want that life anymore. So I just started going another direction really slowly. But I never really had a firm belief that it would work out.
Well, if I go back there and say, what is this going to become? You coming home with a bad back and dirt all over you. Your life is going to be what as a worker at 50, you know, 54 years old? You would have told me what?
If I stayed in that trade?
Yes, if you had just stayed in the bleakness.
I would assume that I maybe had a crew and a couple of trucks and was doing, you know, running a job or two, or, you know, just further along in the same trade, like whatever that means. Like, you know, like if you're working at a McDonald's when you're 23 and someone said, where are you going to be at 54? You go, I'll be managing this McDonald's. That was the conceit. I mean, that's where I figured I was.
How did you escape the bleakness?
I just sort of went, well, let's realistically assess where we're at here. And the realistic assessment was, you're nowhere on the totem pole as it pertains to comedy, but you have ability. So you have ability, but you have no experience, you have no training, and you have no plan. But you do have ability comedically. So what's going to be the training? What's going to be the plan? What's going to be the experience? So I said, I don't know. So I started asking people I knew. I knew a friend of mine's mom, who was like one of my Jewish friends who lived up in the hills. Her mom was like a creative director or something. Her dad was like a composer for the Emmys or something. And I said to her, Chaykin was their last name. I said, what would you do? And she said, I would take a groundlings class. And so I said, okay, what's the groundlings? And said, it's a like improv, you know, out on Melrose in West Hollywood. And I said, okay. She said, you should go watch a show. So I like bought a ticket, saw a groundlings show, thought they were, you know, rock stars in my world. And, you know, they were probably, I was probably 22 and they were probably 27, but I thought they were like older seasoned rock stars. And I said, okay. And I signed up for a class and I just kept taking those classes. I just kept coming back and I'd go from beginning to intermediate, from intermediate to writer's lab, from writer's lab to advanced. And that took years, actually. And I was also trying to do stand, you know, do an open mic stand up. And I'd do anything I could do. Like I kept a notebook and I would write down jokes or ideas or bits or whatever. The Groundlings told me, you're funny, but you can't act. So take an acting class and then you could come back and take the intermediate class, you know? And I was like, okay. And I took an acting class and then they let me come back to take the intermediate class. And at some point, that's all I did. I had no plan. I worked on a construction site during the day. I just worked basic grunt work construction just all day, every day, 5 days a week. And then at night or on the weekends or on the weekends and at night, you know, I'd find myself in some church or something taking a improv class in the basement. And it became pretty clear that I was funny. Like I was pretty good at this stuff. People were laughing. I seemed to get the respect of the other people in the class. And while the other people in the class always were college educated, they always went to some had a college degree, and they were always better actors. They'd studied Shakespeare and they were like drama majors and stuff in their college and in their high school and stuff. I wasn't a theater or drama major. I was sort of a jock. It was clear to me that they knew a lot more about, they were a lot more educated than I was, which means they had a bigger and better vocabulary. And it also meant that they were, and they're better actors and they had more stage experience than I had. But it was clear that I was funnier than they were. And all the training and all the classes and all the drama classes and everything couldn't really bestow that upon you. So I was like, okay, you're not as smart or you're not as educated as these people and you don't have the training they have, but you are funny and you're funnier than they are. So we should be able to do something with that. Like we should be able to take that and give it training and give it the experience.
You can't teach that. You can't really teach funny, right, Adam? Like you could teach a lot of different things, but funny, how is anyone going to be funny, be taught to be funny?
Right. And so that's kind of what I was thinking of. Like I was thinking of it like being athletic. Like you'd rather be really athletic and then learn the game than not be very athletic and know the game very well, right?
Right.
I was just like, okay, now it's going to take a long time for you to learn how to take this funny and get it down to the pavement. Like you got a high horsepower funny engine, but you got to get it through the rear wheels of this car and down to the ground. I sort of instinctively knew that that was going to be the process.
Given what you know and given what you experienced, would you recommend it as a career path to others if somebody comes in and says, hey, I want to do comedy for a living?
Well, if they're funny, I would. But if they're not, I wouldn't. And I don't know if they're funny or not. So I can't say.
you understand what I'm saying, though. The struggles, those basements and those churches and that stuff that you have to do on the grind on the way up, that is a doubt-filled way to try and earn money.
Yeah, I didn't have any thoughts about making a living doing that. I oftentimes think back and I oftentimes think, God, I have two thoughts. I for sure would have made a deal with the devil. Like if you said, look, you're going to make $65,000 a year doing comedy for the rest of your life. But the only caveat is you'll never get a raise. You'll just make $65,000 a year for the rest of your life. But you'll be doing it telling jokes or writing jokes, or maybe you'll just be writing for a greeting card company or something like that. But whatever, you're not going to do construction and you'll do something creative in comedy. for $65,000 a year for the rest of your life, and you'll never get a raise. I would go, give me that goddamn paper. I'm signing it right now. Like, if I was at any point from high school to age 31, I would have went, give me that paper. I'll sign it as fast as I can sign it.
And you're giving away your soul, right? Because it's a deal with the devil. So you're giving away your, it's not just I'm signing that paper. It's I'll take the $65,000 and when I'm dead, I'm going to hell.
No. Which goes against my groundlings training.
Always say yes, Adam. Always say yes.
But no, the point is you're giving away your soul because you're not betting on yourself. That process is giving away your soul. The punishment for that is you'll never have the kind of success you were ever thinking of because you cut a deal, and that deal was you're going to go into class and you're going to be guaranteed a C+, and you sign the deal and you leave the class. But what you're saying is you're never going to get an A. And you're never going to get a B, and you're never going to get an A+. And you've decided to do that. You've hedged your bet on yourself.
Is there anything that you've done, a success that you've had, that you've wanted to throw in your father's face with, how about you eat some of this shit? Like, where it comes out that way, where you want him to see, look, you should have believed in something I was doing.
No, I've done a lot of things, and had a lot of good moments, and he's not into it, so it doesn't really matter. Like, I mean, you can't throw stuff in his face because it doesn't work. You know, it's sort of like you see those stories and they go like, this maniac abducted my 13-year-old daughter and he raped her in the forest and he left her for dead. And then there's that part where the mom goes, I want to look into his eyes and make him understand the pain he's brought to our family. It's like, you go ahead, but he doesn't care. Like, he thought it'd be a good idea to abduct, rape, and kill your 13-year-old daughter. You think you're going to get him to feel guilty? Like,
man,
you think this is going to work on him?
Right. That just sounds, I don't even understand what you're being raised by there, Adam, and forgive the indelicacy of these questions because I know I'm getting in there, but I've heard you talk about the relationship with your father and you talk about it with sort of a distance. You talk about it matter of factly, but it seems like that stuff would be hurtful.
Well, it was, and it is, but it's also when you realize when you have my dad or my mom for a father and a mother, you realize super early that you're on your own and you can't expect anything from them and you're going to have to figure it out yourself. So expectation levels go through the floorboards, right? Often, early, fast. Any kid will do this. Any pet will do this. When you get that, you get the wrong owner, your expectation, you stop asking for stuff. You stop expecting stuff. You stop doing the things that normal people would do. And once that process is underway, and once you get sufficiently shut down, then you're not really upset that, oh, he didn't watch the Oscars and tell you how much he loved it, want to know which jokes were yours, or like any of that stuff. Like, those expectation levels were shut down in the mid-70s, you know? So you don't have the expectation like you would have if you came from a normal environment.
How did it impact your future relationships to have grown up that way? Like, what did you need to learn in terms of where you were cold, where you were repressed, where you were hidden?
Hugging people, telling them you love them, buying them, you know, Easter cards and birthday cards and Christmas cards and all that stuff. I had no idea how any of that worked or why you should do it. You know, like somebody's birthday and I'd go, okay, you know, and they'd go, come on, we're celebrating. And I'd be like, okay, but why? I mean, like, why are we celebrating his birthday? It's like, this birthday, you know, like I didn't know about congratulating people. I didn't know about hugging people. I didn't know about telling them you love them. I didn't know about affirming their beliefs. I didn't know about any of that stuff. I was just like, I didn't know what fork to use at the table. I could barely spell my name. Like, I didn't know anything.
They didn't teach you anything? I mean, you were great at sports, but they didn't teach you anything?
I got out of high school. I couldn't find Michigan on a map. And if you would have told me that Detroit is in Michigan, I would tell you to get the hell out of here. Like, that's as much as I knew.
Well, what were you doing at school? What were you doing? Were you not going to school, or were you not learning at school?
I had sort of a bad school mixed with just staring at the ceiling. Like, I couldn't write. I couldn't read. So I just kind of stared at the ceiling.
You left school illiterate? You left school not being able to read or write?
Yeah, I did. And that's, you know, part of what drove me toward the construction site, because I like construction because they didn't ask questions. You didn't have to read things. You didn't have to spell things. You didn't have to do anything. You could just show up, you know, roll up your sleeves and start digging. And I was good at that. Like, I had a strong back. My thing was, anything physical, give it to me. Anything mental or scholastic oriented or any of that, I don't want it.
When you talk about not being able to share joy, or not having learned how to share joy, of course there'll be some soothing and funny. Like, I'm just curious, what's the most fulfilling? Is there a more fulfilling piece of work that you do than hearing the laughter of an audience?
Yeah, I don't find it that fulfilling. To me, it's my job. So if they don't laugh, then I've not done my job. And if they do laugh, then I'm doing my job. But I don't really get joy from it.
That sucks. How is that possible? You've had some. That sucks, Adam. Like, what do you mean you don't get joy from it? You're just out there doing carpentry?
In a way, I'm doing my job. I mean, when I did my stand-up special and I showed it in a theater, and a group came out to see it in a theater, and I heard them laugh, that did bring me joy. I must admit, it was one of the few times I really felt that. The rest of the time, I'm out doing my job, which is how I perceive it. So because of that, I don't really look at it as joyful. I look at it as dutiful, like it's what I have to do.
The first ever stand-up special that he's talking about, not Taco Bell material. It's available now for purchase at chassy.com, chassy.com, and it's also available on iTunes. Can you tell me a little bit about what that joy felt like? What are you talking about there? I'd like to hear a less acidic, joyful Adam Carolla tell me what that experience was like for you to be able to. I don't know if you had any fear, but if it was conquering fear, all that stuff is hard. Getting up on a stage and doing what you did, especially coming from illiteracy and how much you had to sculpt in order to get there. Explain to me the joy of it.
The joy was going into a world that you never thought you fit into, that you always felt kind of undeserving of. And I used to kind of almost apologize. I'd talk to Sarah Silverman or somebody like that, and she'd say, oh, you're doing stand-up? And I'd go, I'm not doing what you do. I'm just kind of up there telling stories and cracking wise and improvising, whatever. But I'm not really doing stand-up. Like, I somehow was depriving myself of that title. And of course, doing a stand-up special was really kind of off limits emotionally. And I just put it on the calendar, and I just went out and did it. And I got to say, I always sort of had this joke, even though it wasn't a joke, but it was always funny that whenever I'd look at things on IMDb, your favorite movie, if you look at the rating on IMDb, it's 7.2. And if you look at Ocean's 13 or some crap movie, it'll be 6.8. Like, everything on IMDb is between 6.5 and 7.5. The Godfather is 7.4. Gone with the Wind is probably 7.4. And I was like, and I started, and it was a joke. It's like, how does anyone get out of the seventh? And I would look at everyone else's stand-up specials and Jim Gaffigan or Joe Rogan or whoever. Their stand-up says, 7.2, 7.3, 7.5, you know. And I just go, mine's sitting at 8.9. right now, and for some reason that delights me.
It should go out.
You
belong. You belong, motherfucker. You belong. You belong.
There you go.
And as you look at comedy, and we'll let you go on this note and thank you for the time, but as you look at comedy, who are the stand up artists according to you? The sculpting of it. You must admire the craft. Who are you looking at? Not the funniest people in the world, just the people that you look at and you're like, I want to listen to that person riff for 40 minutes.
I hate to give you a non-answer, but I really don't follow stand-up very closely. I tend to listen to a lot more like talk radio and kind of thinkers. And I like guys like Dennis Prager. I like to listen to them pontificate on subjects. So I'm much more into the sort of philosophy and a little less into the comedy.
And so the philosophy that you admire then would be like those that you mentioned, or are there any others that you look at and you're like, I want to follow the spirit of this?
I'll just give a plug to my friend Dennis Prager and tell people he's a very interesting guy. So, very religious Jew. I'm not Jewish and I'm not religious, but there's still a lot that can be gleaned from him.
Adam, we appreciate it. There is a lot that can be gleaned from you as well, whether it's his sangria or his podcast or his books or the new stand-up special, Not Taco Bell Material. It is available now for purchase, chassis.com, chassy.com. Always appreciate your time, Adam. Hope I didn't get too close to the prickly parts of your soul there.
Not at all, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you, buddy. Our thanks to Adam Carolla. Always appreciate that he is generous with his time and with us. A reminder to support the things Lebatard and Friends is offering. Sarah Spain's That's What She Said podcast among them. She has been talking to a lot of people in our universe and allowing you to get to know them a little bit better. She does a fantastic job with her interviews. Mike, before we get out of here, though, tell the people about TESO and how it is TESO is helping us keep all this content free for the people who are listening.
Yeah, shows like Sarah, Mina Kimes, Marty Smith's America, they all appear on our network, and that network is brought to you by TESO. TESO, the official watch of the NBA. Each one of TESO's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. And this graduation season, go ahead and get that graduate in your life a TESO Chrono XL. The TESO Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. Shop now at us.tesoshop.com. Dan, you were mentioning Sarah Spain, and I've seen her around the hall. She's in town this week helping out with Highly Questionable. I consider that podcast to be the crown jewel of the network. I love her interviews, and I know that I'm directly responsible for the South Beach session, as you are. She's better at it than you in terms of interviewing.
So check out that podcast, That's What She Said, with Sarah Spain. We'll talk to you again next week.